You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a mathematician about why picking a perfect March Madness bracket is nearly impossible. First, North Korea and the United States could meet after South Korean officials told President Trump that Kim Jong-un of North Korea wants to talk to him about denuclearization. President Trump says he wants that meeting to happen. Since then, the White House has said terms would need to be met before any meeting with North Korea could take place. Our next guest is here to talk about the history behind these talks and what the meeting could accomplish if it happens. Andrew Kidd is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, this issue of direct head-to-head talks between the leader of the United States and the leader of North Korea, this has been talked about for years and years. North Korea seems to want it. The United States doesn't. Can you talk about some of that history?
Well, North Korea has been pursuing nuclear weapons for almost 30 years now, since the late 80s, early 90s. And we have negotiated with them many times over the years. The biggest deal was in 1994 under President Clinton, when we thought we had put a cap on their program and limited it. That deal collapsed in the early 2000s under George Bush. In Bush's second term, he crafted a series of deals with his Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. Those all collapsed in one way or another, usually after a North Korean warhead test or a missile test. So we have had negotiations with the North Koreans over their missiles many times over the years, but they have always failed to actually achieve denuclearization for certain, or even any sort of lasting halt in the program.
But this idea that North Korea apparently floated of the head of state of each country, Kim Jong-un and, in this case, President Donald Trump getting together, that seems to have been something that North Korea has wanted, the direct talks, not a lower-level negotiation.
Yes, they've wanted direct talks for a long time, and it's really almost miraculous from their point of view that they got them so easily in this case. They would have loved to talk to previous American presidents because it bolsters their international standing. It makes them seem like a more legitimate country. And they're a country with deep internal problems. Their people are cut off from the rest of the world. They've gone through widespread famine and still have a lot of malnutrition in their country. So they have an appalling human rights record. They're not the kind of country, not the kind of leadership that an American president would casually agree to meet normally. So this is a very unusual development.
And White House spokespeople have made it a little less casual since then. I want to give a listen to Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders asking questions from reporters who are raising concerns about this meeting. Here's a listen.
Kim Jong-un gets his equal footing, in his view, on the world stage with the leader of the free world, and the president gets nothing.
Yeah, I definitely don't think that the president's getting nothing when we've already said, and frankly, I've said it many times since walking in here in the last 10 minutes, that the president will not have the meeting without seeing concrete steps and concrete actions take place by North Korea. So the president would actually be getting something, and frankly, the world would be getting something. If we can get to a place where North Korea is denuclearizing, that is a massive step, and it's something that will make the entire globe much safer. And even President Moon has said that this is because of the leadership of President Trump.
So just in the last few days, Andrew, we've gone from yes, the president will do this meeting to yes, the president will do this meeting if some conditions are met, some evidence of denuclearizing in North Korea. How likely do you think it is that we'll see a significant condition like that be met just in the next couple of months, really?
Essentially a zero likelihood. I think that represents people in the White House attempting to try to walk back the president's condition-free acceptance of this proposal of a meeting with the North Koreans. But it's very difficult to walk back things that the president says, especially this president, because he says whatever he likes. And so I think a lot of people would like to attach conditions to it. A lot of people would like it not to happen at all. And there may be, and it's still an open question as to whether it will happen at all. A lot of people are going to be talking to him over the next couple of months, urging him not to have such a meeting. So it's an open question. We'll see. But I think that's what that represents. I mean, the initial acceptance had no conditions whatsoever. beyond, I believe, the North Koreans offered, or at least the South Koreans say the North Koreans offered, not to actually test any missiles or warheads in the period of time between now and when the meetings take place. But that could just be because they don't have anything scheduled to test at that point, so it's not really a huge concession. I certainly don't think you're going to see anything beyond that.
Now, the White House talks about denuclearization of North Korea, and North Korea, again, via South Korea, said, yeah, that can be an issue. We'll talk about denuclearization. Do the two sides mean the same thing when they use that word?
Probably not, although, I mean, I don't think the Kim regime, I don't think Kim is dumb in the sense of not realizing what the Americans mean by it, given that we've been pretty consistent about that over the past, you know, 25 years of negotiations. We want North Korea to get rid of its nuclear weapons, to not have facilities for creating nuclear weapons, uranium enrichment, plutonium reprocessing. We want to get rid of all that stuff in a verifiable way, verified by international Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, so that they don't have nuclear weapons and can't build them anymore. And the most they've been willing to offer ever has been a freeze, that they won't make any more than they already have. And so it's interesting to see what will happen. Maybe Trump will accept that, I don't know, when he gets into negotiations. But it's very difficult for me to imagine that the North Koreans are going to offer anything more than a freeze, given that that's all they've ever agreed to for a long time, and that they view nuclear weapons as essential to their survival in confrontation with the United States and with South Korea. So it would be really unprecedented if they did agree to more than that.
Talking to Andrew Kidd, political scientist at UW-Madison, looking at the at least hypothetical meeting between President Trump and the leader of North Korea. And Andrew, let's pick up on a point you just made, how essential nuclear weapons are as seen by North Korea. They view it as a survival issue. Why would they give them up if they're a powerful deterrent from outside intervention? Is there going to be any kind of incentive that would get them to do that?
Well, the big incentive would have to be some kind of either peace treaty or possibly the withdrawal of American troops from South Korea, some sort of ending of the United States military relationship with South Korea. We could do that, certainly, and I'm sure the North Koreans would love for that to happen. And the North Koreans might agree to something in exchange for that, but it's even that, it's I rather suspect that they would find a way to cheat on that, given their previous behavior.
Well, let's bring South Korea in at that point, because they might view the American troop presence as their guarantee against a North Korean attack.
Yes, and that's how it has been since 1953, the Korean War. So we have had troops there ever since and have no plans at this point to get rid of them. You have to basically bring in the Chinese at that point, because the Chinese are the only ones who really have the kind of leverage over North Korea that would be required to get them to get rid of nuclear weapons. And the only reason the Chinese would be willing to do it would be if they did see some possibility of getting the United States off the Korean Peninsula. And then you might begin to really get somewhere. But it's hard for me to believe that with the North Koreans just by themselves, you're actually going to get to that kind of result.
I've seen some critiques from people with experience in the diplomatic community saying, hold on, a big head of state, the head of both countries getting together to talk about complex issues like these, you need a lot of groundwork, you need a lot of lower-level meetings to negotiate about what you're negotiating about. Do you see that happening with the Trump administration in North Korea in the about 2 months since until they're talking about having this meeting?
Yes, well, that's typically what happens. Like when you had summits between American leaders and Soviet leaders during the Cold War or other such sort of high-profile summit meetings, you had a lot of preparation by staff people crafting out agreements that they could sign, things that they could talk about, really negotiating about the agenda. And that is perhaps beginning to happen now, although my guess is that a lot of the people, well, there's two issues. One, a lot of people don't want it to happen at all. And two, the State Department is so hollowed out at this point, they don't even have an ambassador to South Korea. The lead negotiator that we had with North Korea is resigning. A lot of people don't want to serve in this administration, and the State Department is basically being sidelined when it comes to Korean policy. So you don't have that depth of expertise and that sort of staff to work this issue at this point. And Trump is so unpredictable that it's hard to, I mean, you could do that and he could just wander right off the reservation on day one. So it's not clear that it's going to get that kind of preparation that summits typically have in the past.
On potential upside, as you mentioned earlier, we've had past carefully negotiated deals that fell through. Could personal diplomacy like this actually accomplish something different?
Yeah, that is a possibility. And if you look, historically speaking, Reagan and Gorbachev are all often pointed to as two leaders who, somewhat unexpectedly, given Reagan's strong anti-communist leanings to begin with, hit it off, in a sense, and became, if not close friends, at least developed some sort of trust relationship between them. So that is one example, and that, of course, helped end the Cold War, which was enormously consequential. So if Trump and Kim were to hit it off in that way, perhaps you might see something. That was kind of an iterated relationship. It took place over time, right? Reagan met Gorbachev 5 times over the course of his 2 terms in office. It's not clear that that's going to happen here, but I suppose it's possible.
And some people have said, hey, compare this to the Iran deal looks easy compared to what we want to get out of North Korea. How do you compare and contrast those two different nuclear diplomacy efforts?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting case and full of ironies. So the Iran deal stopped a Iranian enrichment program before it led to getting atomic weapons for Iran. And Trump has just excoriated that deal. It was terrible, weak, a disaster, et cetera. Here we've got a country in North Korea that has nuclear weapons. Some people think they've got dozens, maybe even into the low hundreds of nuclear weapons. And it's basically broken every agreement that they've ever signed. And yet Trump is interested in talking to them at this point, and interested potentially in scuppering the Iran deal, which appears to be working and has kept Iran on this side of the nuclear threshold. So, and also, of course, the connection between the two. If the United States scuppers the Iran deal, then what message does that send to Kim about whether we live up to our side of agreements or not? And it may lower the incentive for Kim Jong-un to negotiate with the United States.
As we wrap up, Andrew, what are you going to be watching for in the next few weeks to try to figure out even if this thing is going to happen?
Well, I mean, I'm guessing you're going to see a lot of people on the American side trying to attach preconditions to it, like you saw with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, preconditions that are going to be difficult, if not impossible, for the North Koreans to meet, or simply things that they don't want to meet. And so it may get derailed in that way. Trump may hire some new negotiator who may sort of have some influence on that. That's probably one thing you're going to see. You may even see strange things out of the North Koreans, right? The North Koreans haven't fully confirmed the outline of the proposal that the South Koreans came with. So it's not even clear that the North Koreans have made this offer in exactly the same terms that the South Koreans have represented. So it could come unglued from a number of different angles.
Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Andrew Kidd, professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about a potential U.S.-North Korea diplomatic meeting. Now we're just days away from the first games of the NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Championship, also known as March Madness. Over 5 dozen teams will duke it out, pardon the pun, over the next few weeks to become a top college basketball team in the country. As a heads up, Marquette and UW-Madison did not make it this year, but even with the heartbreak over the Wisconsin teams, you can still fill out your bracket to pick the winners of each and every game. Well, all right, some more bad news for you. The likelihood that you'll fill out a perfect bracket, really long odds. Paul Peters is with us now to talk about the math behind the bracket and why aiming for perfection might not be worth your time. He's a math instructor at Madison College. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, glad to be here.
All right, what are the odds of getting a perfect bracket beginning to end all the way through?
Well, it's summed up in one word, it's ridiculous. It's about 1 in 9.2 quintillion. So you can think of that as a 9 with 18 zeros after it.
So let me think, billions, then trillions, then quadrillions, and then quintillion,
every
all the way over there.
Yes, exactly.
That is very unlikely, in layman's terms, if I have that right.
Yes, to say the least. It's very unlikely, near impossible.
Now, Paul, a lot of people are out there thinking, that's if I chose each game randomly. But I have a method. I'm going to get it right. I'm joking a little bit, but the fact that some games we're probably going to get right, it does reduce that or increase our odds a little bit, right?
Sure, absolutely. So an easy way to think about that would be, in the history of the men's tournament, at least, no 16 seed has ever beaten a 1 seed. So you get to remove 4 of those games with sort of assuming that that outcome holds. Well, that'll get you down from 1 in 9.2 quintillion to about 1 in 570 quadrillion.
Still long
odds. Not a big shift. But yes, obviously with knowledge about past competition, schedules, all of that, those odds improve. And in fact, there's a math professor at DePaul University, I believe, who hypothesizes that it's down to about 1 in 128 billion.
That's still not great betting odds.
No. There are many other events out there that are more likely to happen.
Yeah, talk about some of
the bracket.
Put this in context. What is more likely to happen to us than getting that, especially that randomly chosen
bracket?
Well,
if we want to get morbid on those topics,
and we do,
say, well, you know, let's say it's March and people are heading to warmer climates for spring break. The odds that you're killed by a falling coconut are about 1 in 250 million.
Wow.
If you worry about what's going on at home, the odds that you're injured by soap is about 1 in 11,000.
So it's way more likely that I'm going to hurt myself with soap than get that perfect bracket. Any other comparison and contrast for odds of things happening?
Well, sure. The odds of becoming president of the United States are about 1 in 10 million. I like to combine things. So, you know, the likelihood that somebody's struck by lightning is about 1 in 700,000. But the likelihood that you're struck by lightning while drowning is about 1 in 183 million.
Okay, now these are all very long odds, none of them even close still to our perfect bracket.
No. The perfect bracket is so far beyond that.
All right, let's make things a little easier. Set aside the perfect bracket. How about the odds of getting the first 32 games right?
Well, the first 32 games, then you'd be looking at, and that would require a quick calculation from me, so give me just 2 seconds here. But if you're looking at the first 32 games, then you're basically looking at about 1 in 4.2 billion.
That doesn't seem like it'd be that hard with 32 games and only 2 choices in each, but the odds stack up that fast.
The odds stack up. The way the counting principle works here is that really there's 2 choices for each game, and that multiplies through. So if you're picking 32 games, it's a 2 times a 2 times a 2 32 times, or 2 to the 32nd power.
So my odds are 1 over 2 to the 32nd.
Exactly.
And so 2 to the 1st is 2, then 4, then 8, then 16, then 32. And you keep doubling.
Yep, you've got it. So you can play that game all day long. What if I get, how about the first 10 games? So 1 over 2 to the 10th power.
The nice thing, though, is that the competition isn't to get the perfect bracket. It's to get the perfectest bracket among
That's
the people
exactly
you're playing
right.
with.
So if you need to stay positive, the idea is somebody is going to win that pool. They won't win it with the perfect bracket, but they'll win the pool.
And we'll be really impressed if they do win it with the perfect bracket.
You know, I'm not even going to think about it because that mathematical portion of my brain just knows it's not going to happen.
I guess a few years ago, Warren Buffett and I think Quicken Loans offered $1 billion to anyone that got a perfect bracket.
Yes.
That sounds like, wow, that's a lot of money to give away. But compare that billion to the 1 in over 9 quintillion, their money's fairly safe.
Yes, it was a safe bet on his part. And I think he's tweaked it every year since then. I think this year he's looking maybe to get every game right through the Sweet 16.
Then you still win money for that.
And then it was, I think his offer was $1 million a year for life.
I tend not to, that's pretty sweet. I'd take that.
Yep.
I tend not to do brackets myself. Are you a bracket doing person?
You know, I do it for fun occasionally, although when looking at the odds the odds that you would find out that your child is a genius is 1 in 250. So I'm thinking maybe I just take my bracket home and give it to one of my daughters and let them fill it out.
And if you have 250 kids, it's a lock.
Well,
one of them's got to be a genius.
You got to find the right one, right?
I may be taking some shortcuts on the math here. What's your best bracket ever been?
You know, my best bracket maybe has been in the range of getting about 42 to 44 of the games correct overall. So you can look at binomial distributions and sort of play that game. You know, for instance, the likelihood that someone maybe, let's say, gets at least 30 games correct would be about 40%.
Okay. Now, in your life as a math person, I mean, are you looking at things in your daily life and kind of mathing them up a little bit?
I try not to because I know what that would do to the people around me.
And it's like taking your work home with you, though.
Yeah, I want to have a social life. I want my wife to want to spend time with me.
And that said, though, in the classroom, taking these real-world examples that are maybe on people's minds has got to be a great tool, right, to teach some of these principles of, say, statistics.
Yeah, it's a hook, right? You can catch their attention and pull their focus in for a few moments, and that's all you need sometimes.
And will you be watching March Madness this year, bracket or no?
I will watch it, yes.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
Paul Peters is a math instructor at Madison College. He joined us to talk about the mathematical odds of creating a perfect bracket. We don't use the word quintillion enough here on Central Time. Now, populist and nationalist parties have seen a lot of success lately, most recently in Italy, where far-right populist parties scored big successes in national elections. And in some countries, populist leaders have taken office and started to dismantle the levers of government, consolidating power and punishing their enemies. Think places like Turkey, Russia, and Hungary, to name a few. Our next guest sees this as a disturbing trend around the world and here in the United States. And with a growing sense of frustration in traditional political parties, he says people are losing patience with representative government and individual rights and more willing to accept authoritarian leadership. Yasha Monk is a lecturer on government at Harvard University, columnist at Slate.com, and host of the Good Fight podcast. His new book is The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Yasha, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, before we get into the spread of these populist movements, you say one big precondition here is a perception among a lot of people that the establishment or the political elites aren't serving the needs of the people. And you say that perception is rooted in reality. How so?
Well, look, for a long time, people didn't love politicians, didn't completely trust what's going on in Washington, D.C. But from 1930 to 1965, the living standard of the average American doubled. From then till 1985, it doubled again. And since 1985, it's actually been flat, essentially been stagnant. Changes how people think about politics. Now they say, you know what, I've worked pretty hard all my life. I didn't have that much to show for it. So let's try something new. How bad could things get?
So talk about the scope of the spread of populist movements, Yasha.
Yeah, so what we're seeing is all of these politicians and political movements that really challenge the most fundamental aspects of our political system gaining a lot.
I'm going to jump in. We have a bad connection, Yasha, so I'm going to have our producer reconnect with you. Hang up for just a moment, and we'll have the producer give you a call. We are talking to Yasha Monk, lecturer on government at Harvard University. He's a columnist at Slate.com and host of the Good Fight podcast. We're talking about his new book. It's called The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. We'll get him back on the line in just a few moments. You can call in with your questions and thoughts on this idea at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page as you see populist movements and populism as a political tactic do better and better in countries around the world. What do you think? Are you worried? Are you hopeful? 800-642-1234, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to our guests if we've got a better connection. Yasha, are you there?
I'm here. Hope okay. The connection's better this time around.
I think I'm hearing you better now. So I start again with the rise of populist movements around the world. Talk about how widespread this is.
So it's very widespread. When you look at Europe, for example, the average vote share of a populist movement in 2000 was 8%. By now, it is 25%. And what's important about these movements is they don't just say, we want to change up our politics, it's done. They don't just say, hey, there's a lot of things that are wrong with the current beliefs. They actually say that they alone truly represent the people. And that anybody who disagrees with them is illegitimate, is a traitor, is an enemy of the people. So that's why it makes me worried about the stability of democracy, because we have to have agreement not on every public policy, but on the basic rules and norms and institutions that make our system work.
And that rise of these populist parties, as you point out, it's coming, especially in Europe, with a real lack of support or decline in support for the long-term traditional parties, right?
Yes, absolutely. So what you see, for example, in Italy, where there was a very interesting election a week ago, is that there had been a populist prime minister, Silvio Berlusconi, who weakened the independence of the judiciary, who kept attacking media in extreme form. He was actually repudiated in 2011, lost a lot of popularity, had to resign from office in disgrace, was even sentenced for paying to have sex with a minor. And yet, 7 years on, he's back. He's the kingmaker in Italian politics once again. And there's other populist parties and movements that are even stronger than him now. In fact, between them, these three movements now have close to two-thirds of the vote, raising real questions about what's going to be happening in Italian politics and in European politics of the euro in the years to come.
You write that one of the key elements of a populist message is offering very often simple solutions to what are very complex problems. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, look, if the stop clock is right twice a day, I think populists tend to be right four or five times a day in their analysis. They often channel real frustrations that people have. They point to things that really are a problem. One of them, for example, is that our politics is not sufficiently responsive to people's views, that the rich and big corporations have too much influence over our politics. So they exploit that anger and right in part of the diagnosis, but the solution is always the same. They say everything is actually simple. You can solve everything through common sense as long as you have a great populist spokesperson, a great populist hero who actually is able to speak for the people. And so once they get into office, they tend to concentrate power into their own hands, to delegitimize independent institutions, the media, courts, and so on and so forth. And eventually, it becomes impossible to dislodge a democratically elected prime minister or president through democratic means. And that's happening, for example, in Hungary at the moment, which looked like a stable democracy 5 or 10 years ago, and now no longer has free and fair elections.
And scapegoating is another part of the story. Part of the simple solution, often you write, is that there is some very particular group of people to blame. How do you see that playing out in different countries?
Absolutely. So, look, there's many reasons why the living standards of average Americans have stagnated. Some of them have to do with actual political choices, with, tax laws that favor the rich while not doing much for the middle class. But there's also more complicated causes of it. There's automation. There's the fact that technological progress is not as fast as it was in the 50s and 60s. Well, what populists say is, all you need to do is to drain the swamp. All you need to do is to throw out the current elite, and I promise you everything is going to get better. Now, once populists are in power, they have something to explain. Because you know what? Things don't miraculously get better overnight. They say, hey, who knew that things could be so complicated? Who knew that healthcare could be so complicated? Who knew that the Middle East could be so complicated? So instead of admitting that they've made a mistake, that they had an overly simplistic prescription, they start to say, you know why I'm not delivering on you? I'm not delivering for you because there are all of these sinister minorities who have too much of an influence in our politics. You know why I'm not delivering for you? I'm not delivering for you because actually the press is criticizing me all of the time, and that's all fake news, that's all sabotage. You know I'm not delivering for you because the judges are trying to uphold the Constitution, but they're actually enemies of the people.
This isn't as surprising, say, in a fledgling democracy, the post-Soviet world that didn't have that much experience with electoral democracy. You're worried that even in some of the longest-running representative governments, France, the United States, elsewhere, that even those long-running institutions might not survive populism.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think that a few years ago, most political scientists in this country would have said a candidate who threatens to lock up his political adversary, who says that he will keep voters in suspense about whether he'll accept the outcome of the election, would never be acceptable as a president of his country. That a majority of people would never vote for a candidate like that. Well, we've seen that change. I think even a year ago, even once Donald Trump was in office, most people in the United States would have said, well, if he really attacks the FBI, the Department of Justice, institutions which people on both sides of the aisle have long respected in a fundamental way, people aren't going to turn on those institutions. Well, we've seen that that turned out to be wrong. Now, look, obviously the United States has a deeper democratic tradition than Hungary and Poland. It has more checks and balances. We're seeing some tremendous activity to try and rescue and support these institutions. But it's worth remembering that 5 years ago, most political scientists, most experts of Central Europe, thought that democracy was safe in countries like Hungary as well. And now we're seeing it recede very rapidly.
Do you see an almost international populist movement? You see Putin in Russia supporting nationalist groups in France and elsewhere. Steve Bannon was just talking to the French National Front and giving shout-outs to leaders in Hungary and other countries you're worried about. Is there an international scene where populists are supporting each other across borders?
Yeah, there is what I would call the liberal international, people who have very similar views, who have a real tendency towards strongman rule. And what's worrying about it is that they're starting to create both a systemic alternative to democracy and a playbook by which to weaken it. So Viktor Orban a few years ago said, I'm against liberal democracy. What I want is hierarchical democracy in which the prime minister really gets to decide what happens throughout the country, gets to institute his own judges, gets to put his people into all of the main state agencies. And he's become very popular by giving big handouts to his own supporters, by portraying the Hungarian nation as being under threat, for example, by U.S. citizens, by refugees, but also just by Jews and other minorities. And he has managed to use that rhetoric in order to make people rally around the flag. Now, what's striking about Donald Trump is that he is doing some of those same things, but he hasn't done it in a very disciplined way. For example, he hasn't really delivered on some of the people who had deep economic frustration who voted for him in the first place. And my fear is that if he becomes wiser, if he actually learns from the job, which he so far seems to have proven resistant to.
We're talking to Yascha Mounk. His new book is The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. He says populist movements in the United States and around the world are threatening representative governments and individual liberties. You can join us with your comments and questions at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the growing appeal of populist movements around the world here in the country? We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Yascha Mounk is with us, author of The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. He says the rise of populist movements in countries around the world is a threat to representative governments and individual liberty. Countries from Hungary and Russia to France and Italy to the United States. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Do you share his concerns? Are you worried about the survival of representative governments like the United States? 800-642-1234 is the number. Go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Lake Mills. Mike, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for having me on. I discuss this a lot with the younger folks at work and out at the college about this populist movement. And I bring the, we'll say, the catapulting of this movement back to about 2008, a little before the worldwide economic collapse. And I attribute it to conservatives who have always during elections appealed to the Nazis, that have always appealed to populists, that have always appealed to white supremacists for votes.
Mike, thanks for the call. Yasha, Mike sees ancestors here, at least political rhetoric of the past leading up to our current populist moment. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely right. One of the important things to realize is that, you know, we always imagine the moment when democracies perish as, you know, Nazis marching in the street doing the Hitler salute, you know, with black boots and torches that are on fire. That's not normally how it works. What you see instead is a slow ratcheting up of rhetoric against the existing political system, this slow way in which our discourse becomes more and more extreme, in which we start seeing people on the other side of the political divide as enemies rather than adversaries, and that creates the opening for people to amass more and more power in their own hands. And we're seeing some of those things in the United States right now.
Let's bring on another caller. Elena is with us in Milwaukee. Elena, hi.
Hi. I'm really worried about democracy. So I see a lot of people joining grassroots groups. I think, you know, the small movement is starting, and I think that people are paying attention because there's so much going on to suppress the voter.
Elena, thanks for the call. And Yasha, Elena takes us into the second half of your book, The Response to the Rise of the Populist Movement. And she mentioned grassroots groups starting. What do you see as being, if people want to resist the rise of populism, what is an effective form of resistance?
So the first thing we absolutely need to do is to make sure that populists don't win election the second or third time. So, you know, what you see in countries like Poland and Hungary and so on, is that when populists gain election again, they start to destroy the political system, and it's very dangerous. So I think that, you know, opposing people who don't accept the most basic rules and norms of the political system through political campaigning and other forms of political activity is absolutely crucial. But we need to go beyond that. People don't accept the democratic system at the moment because they have deep frustrations with how things have been going, because they feel that the system isn't responsive enough to them and that they need to have more material progress and so on. So actually showing that we can have a moderate politics that is not extremist, but that deals with those things, that gives people hope for a better future, is just as important in making people win trust in the political system again.
That sounds like it's easier said than done, because the reason we're at this moment is because political leaders either haven't tried to do these things or haven't been able to agree on the best paths to get there, right?
Absolutely. When I look at the 2016 election, it seems to me like a contest between an extremist politics of change and a moderate politics of the status quo. And what you see in those circumstances is that people might choose the extremist politics of change, not because most Americans are extremists, but because they want an actual promise of things getting better. So I think that, you know, moderate political parties, concretely United States, the Democrats, need to actually offer a better vision of how politics can be done in a way that delivers for them. That isn't giving in to some of the political extremes, but that's actually putting forward a realistic vision of how people are going to have more money in their pockets, how the political system is going to respond to what they want, and so on and so forth.
Speaking of faith in the democratic system, you cite some surveys that have been done over a bunch of years showing that more and more people, even younger people, especially younger people, say it's not necessarily important to live in a democracy, and people being more open to the idea that a military government or authoritarian government is an acceptable form of government.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have, a lot more young people saying that it's not important to them to live in a democracy than old people. You have 20 years ago, 1 in 16 Americans saying that they like the idea of army rule. Now it's 1 in 6. You have a real increase across Europe in the number of people who say they want a strongman leader who doesn't have to bother with parliament and elections. So this is one of the signs that people aren't just unhappy with particular governments, with particular politicians, but that they're unhappy with the political system in itself.
Do you think we're in a generation now where the people who fought in World War II are now passing away? They're not part of the body politic as much anymore. We don't have that direct experience of the worst that populist nationalism has to offer. Is there a historical memory problem?
Yes, absolutely. People used to say, hey, I can see that there's bad things in our system, but I also see how bad things were in fascist countries, in communist countries. And so I'm not going to make too many experiments. I'm not going to risk seeing our system be destroyed and something potentially quite terrible taking its place. At this point, people say, you know what, I can see all the bad things in the system. I don't have much imagination of what an alternative would look like. So, you know, let's try things. And as I was saying earlier, it doesn't take people to actually have a principled preference for an alternative to democracy for that kind of thing to arise. It's enough for them to say, I'm so fed up with the system. I'm not really fearful of what else might happen. So let's give somebody pretty extreme a shot. How bad could things get?
Do you see a response, an effective response to populism starting to emerge around the world?
Yes, I think you're starting to see people recognize at least the extent of the danger. I think you see a lot of courageous individuals and a lot of great civil society organizations trying to stand up in a nonpartisan way for the things that we should all agree on, which is the basic rules and norms of our political system. But you also see difficulty of opposition movements actually uniting, leaving some of the policy differences aside in order to concentrate on the things that they have in common. And once populists are in power, they have access to tremendous levers of control. They can put pressure on media organizations. They can start to put their own political cronies and their own friends and relatives into positions of power in independent bureaucratic institutions and so on. So it's an uphill battle. And I think in the United States, we should be grateful for the fact that for now, we retain our ability to fight for our convictions and fight for our political system. And that makes it all the more urgent that we do that now.
And we'll leave it there. Yasha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Sorry about the bad line.
That's Yasha Monk. He's a lecturer on government at Harvard University, a columnist at Slate.com, and senior fellow in the political reform program at New America. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the issues that he raised. You can do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think there.